My name is Gary Coles. I'm a family physician from northern Minnesota who has been involved in a medical practice at a state mental institution where there are many, many people, virtually the vast majority of the people there have been affected by violence. Their mental illness, their personality disorders, their chemical dependency have as their root cause violence. It's either the violence of war, combat, or being a civilian in a war zone, the violence of rape, the violence of incest or other forms of child sexual abuse, the violence of physical abuse, the violence of racism, the violence of poverty. All of these things are horrible, have horrible effects on people's psyches, their mental capacity. Violence has a way of embedding the horrors into one's brain. Whenever there's a horrible situation in combat, thinking you're going to get killed or some horrible situation, even watching a R-rated horror movie, there's adrenaline flowing in your body, and adrenaline has a way of embedding the experience, the memory in your brain, and that causes it to be intrusive. It tends to come back. It tends to cause nightmares. It causes bad daydreams or what we call flashbacks of the original trauma. It's a devastating situation. It's probable that most of us in this room may not have experienced that type of terror, and so we may have trouble understanding that. But I deal with it on a day-to-day basis, mainly in people who are chemically dependent, alcoholic, or using other drugs that cause addiction. And what they are trying to do is to assuage the trauma, the psychological trauma, that pain, that mental anguish in their brain by using alcohol. Doesn't work. It works great temporarily. It does that numbing of one's psychological faculties, but it compounds the problem by then adding another problem onto the already mental illness. PTSD has only been a diagnosis accepted by the American Academy of Psychiatry since 1980. It has, however, been present from the beginning of time when people started being violent to other people, especially in wartime. And that is when post-traumatic stress disorder first came to our consciousness lately with the returning Vietnam veterans. I should maybe just briefly define it. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a mental illness caused by psychological trauma of a degree or intensity beyond normal human experience. Those things I mentioned. The worst ones are rape and incest, physical abuse, and then combat violence. So when the Vietnam veterans came home, they started talking about the horrors of that war. They were in a situation in a war they didn't believe in. It was an undeclared war. It was a political war. It was there because we were fending off communism and protecting capitalism, basically. That it's more profound than that, more involved than that. But these innocent soldiers volunteered or were drafted to go and fight against an enemy that was hard to see, hard to identify. It was in a jungle environment with all sorts of dangers, and it was a 24-hour kill or be killed situation. Much death and suffering and grotesqueness all around. These guys were seeing their buddies dying, and they couldn't do anything about it. They were killing people. They got into situations where they were killing innocent civilians. The My Lai massacre, you know, read about the My Lai massacre. They were innocent civilians, children, women, and old men, basically, that were just in the insanity of war, were annihilated Nazi style by normal, our next door neighbor, GIs, American GIs. it happens in every war, you know. It happened, the North Vietnamese did the same thing, I suppose, to our boys. And it happened in any war that's a guerrilla war, there are situations where there are just horrible episodes. And all that stuff, and then there was rape, you know, the old adage that the fruits of war are rape and pillage, you know, I sort of chuckled at that. It's the truth, you know, my great uncle did it. Whereby men who go into the military do so with that, that is part of the advantage. Discussing wartime, it would be fill, you know, books and books, and I can't go into that very much now, but understand that war is hell, and it causes a destruction of the normal psychological defenses, so that people who are engaged in that, even the victims, have the trauma that they have trouble getting rid of. Of course, we mainly are talking about our soldiers going over there and committing atrocities and then going crazy with it afterwards when they come home, and that happened. 58,000 United States soldiers died in Vietnam. Far more than that committed suicide after the war was over when they came back. In one of the psychiatric journals I read, there was an estimate that 120,000 Vietnamese veterans committed suicide, killed themselves after they came home from Vietnam. We only hear about the 58,000 that died in Vietnam. That tells you that there's severe guilt, there's severe depression, there's severe trouble that's going on in the people who view grotesque violence and violence of any kind, basically. Combat-induced post-traumatic stress disorder kind of depends on the intensity and the duration of the combat experience. They have done many studies of returning veterans, and this applies to World War I, World War II, Civil War, Korean, any war where there is combat, where people are killing each other, where they are injuring each other, where they're seeing grotesque death and that sort of thing, it happens. We don't hear about it much because it's not considered patriotic to tell the truth about war. The Pentagon and the Veterans Administrations have been absolutely unconscionable at hiding the truth of this and not dealing with these terrible victims of this violence, because they don't want the truth out. They want those of us who are civilians to think war is, you know, okay. And there's lots of reasons for that. It's also expensive to treat post-traumatic stress disorder, so the Veterans Administration has suppressed the truth. They have not dealt honestly with these terrible victims of this combat stress. Part of the reason I'm bringing this up, and we can go on and talk about, you know, the violence of rape and the violence of poverty, the violence that humans do to other humans, you know, gay bashing, anti-gospel, anti-Christian, racism, the violence of oppressing others because of the color of their skin, anti-gospel, anti-Christian. Fear of foreigners, you know, fear of someone of a different faith, the violence that goes along with that, and often we're mainly talking about physical violence, but the intense psychological violence and the fear can do the same thing. I could tell you 1,000 stories of patients of mine, and they all have different ones, and the violence they have experienced is, there's not one that's the same. It's a terrible, terrible tragedy that results in not only the mental anguish, but the spiritual destruction of these people. The Vietnam veterans who are severely affected, and I'm talking about combat veterans. A lot of people went to Vietnam and they were in the Air Force, you know. At 35,000 feet in a B-52, you're pulverizing the people and splashing and burning napalm and burning the children. You don't know that it happened. You don't see the pain. You don't hear the cries. You don't see the suffering. And so it's easy to not get PTSD if you're in the Air Force. Same with the Navy. You're lobbing shells tens of miles, destroying whatever is there. This is not, those things they may say, well, we're killing military targets. They are killing civilians as well. It's indiscriminate shelling. They may say, well, we're pretty precise, but just like in the Iraq War, most of the bombs there weren't smart bombs. They were destroying civilians, but they didn't see the carnage. They didn't see the brutality, and so they escaped. But only the ones that had an intact conscience and intact spirituality and the realization that they are killing innocent children of God, they are often affected. One of the, again, I could tell you hundreds and thousands of stories, but one of the patients that I actually read about during World War II, during the firebombing of Japanese cities, those were destroying civilian targets in cities as well as military targets. But one pilot was doing a low-level bombing mission just at the top of the buildings, and he went crazy with post-traumatic stress disorder because as he had released the napalm behind him, which is burning gasoline in a jelly mixture, and it just burns intensely anything that it hits, and he was just flying over there. He had just released the napalm, and he saw a little Japanese boy looking up in wonder at this plane that was going over, and the pilot knew that he was going to die. He was going to die a horrible death, burning to death with napalm, and that affected him. He saw the eye of the so-called enemy, and he knew it was an innocent child of God, and that pilot got PTSD. The ones that fly at 35,000 feet that have that conscious numbed, they're able to forget that. But what happens then with this intrusive memory? People with PTSD have horrible nightmares generally. The memory is indelibly engraved in their brains, and they have terrible nightmares so that they also have insomnia. They can't get a good night's sleep because they're afraid, or they actually do have the memory of the original trauma going through their brains. And many is the combat veteran that has awakened with, strangling his wife, thinking so clearly of that combat experience, and someone's coming after him, for instance, and they actually wake up strangling their wife because the memory is so vivid. Or in the daytime, they have little triggers that bring back the memory, and they just sweat, and they get high blood pressure and tachycardia, and they panic, and they're just like they're back in the rice paddies of Vietnam. They smell rice. Rice was a pervasive odor in Vietnam. Or they smell fish, or they smell petroleum from the fuel dumps of the military. Many, many things trigger the event. One of the Vietnam veterans said he was just driving down, his car stopped, he looked off, and there was a woman in a black running suit, and it just brought back the image of a Vietnamese woman in black that he remembers, and he instinctively reached for his gun. He said, I just want to put her out of her misery. He had killed a woman like that, and this was an American woman, Minneapolis street corner. And so it's just that irrational violence coming back to these poor people. So they have daytime memory, they have intrusive nighttime memory, they are so afraid of going to sleep that they don't get enough rest, and then they don't function well in the daytime. So affected Vietnam veterans of any place, or sexual abuse victims, survivors of any of these traumas, oftentimes cannot concentrate. And especially young children who have been sexually or physically abused, when they're in school, they sleep poorly, and so they have trouble concentrating in the daytime, and so they do poorly in school. I treat half my patients, chemical dependency patients, are Native Americans. We have a pretty good Native American program. And many of these women come in with their chemical dependency, and they have been told that they are mentally retarded. But yet I see these women are sharp and bright and alert, given the fact that they've been through all sorts of trouble. And what has happened is that they have been physically or sexually abused, or in an abusive situation, a very dysfunctional family where there's drinking and violence between parents. They may not have even been sexually or physically abused themselves, although that is very common. As a function of all sorts of things, including racism and poverty and low joblessness, et cetera. It isn't because they're Native American, you know. That happens with impoverished people. It happens with wealthy people. It is not, I'm not implying that Native Americans shall be frowned upon because this happens to be common. I could go into the 500 years of colonialism and genocide that the Native Americans have been victims of. But anyway, these women who now have children and are adults started out as victims of violence, survivors of violence, and when they went to school, they couldn't concentrate. They were thinking of the violence that happened at night. They're worried about their mother getting beat up, or they're worried about someone coming into the room and raping them. All this stuff interfered with their ability to learn. And so they fail, you know. Who wouldn't? You know, when you can't concentrate, when you can't do algebra because you're worrying about what happened last night, and then you didn't get enough sleep on top of that, and that's been going on for weeks and months or years, you do not do well in school. So eventually they do poorly in school. Sometimes they run away from home. Oftentimes the Native Americans have been taken out of their homes and put in with white parents in a white school, and now they're by themselves without any support group of their own race. And so then they're also victims of the cruelty that children often show to other children of a different race or someone that's different. And then also they're women, you know. Women in a male-dominated society are victims of sexism. So that's another type of violence. So eventually they drop out of school. I haven't seen one yet with chemical dependency problems in adulthood that have been victims of violence as children who has not dropped out of school. They were not nurtured in that environment. If they were sexually abused, they develop sexual identity problems or inappropriate sexuality. It's a given, it's a truism that people who have been terribly violated in childhood are retarded at that age in their social development. So that if they've been traumatized as a, you know, preschooler, much of their personality is kind of retarded. They don't develop because they feel alone, they feel empty inside, they have trouble relating to other people, they have this fear, they have this, you know, intrusive memory, they have the nightmares. They can't develop normally, so they're at this huge disadvantage. And so they develop inappropriate sexuality, and that oftentimes results in prostitutions or early pregnancies or chemical abuse. They oftentimes start abusing chemicals in their early teenage years, again, to get rid of that, assuage that horrible mental anguish of the memory. And so that infringes on their ability to learn and their school careers as well. And it often is expensive, and so then sometimes that results in prostitution to support their drug habit, which oftentimes is, you know, harder drugs than alcohol. So it's just a downward spiral. I mean, it's devastating, and they lose their spirituality, just like the Vietnam veterans that are terribly affected with PTSD. How can they believe in a loving God when they have seen, you know, the equivalent of hell all around them, and no mercy, no compassion, no forgiveness? You know, is this the way of Christ? Most of the Vietnam veterans were good, decent Christian people, you know. We have military chaplains who are good, decent Christian chaplains who say nothing about, you know, Jesus' clear teachings about nonviolence or the prohibition against killing, you know. By the time you get into military and gone through basic training, you have to give an oath that you will obey unconditionally your superior officer. In order to, and of course you are a paid professional killer, depending on, you know, with more or less intensity, you know, Marines and combat soldiers are the ones that, you know, kill face to face and are the ones that really have to hone their ability to be cruel and be effective killers. Again, you know, Air Force and Navy is a different type of situation, but they all have given an oath that they will follow their commanding officer. So if the commanding officer is at Mi Lai, Lieutenant Callie, and says you use your M16 and mow down these innocent people, then you do it, or you're up for court-martial, or you are ridiculed or oppressed in other ways. This is a story that doesn't get told by the ROTC, the Reserve Officer Training Corps people that come into most schools. They're very seductive. You know, they'll pay for education, you'll have pay for uniforms, and lots of advantages, but they don't tell the potential outcome of what can happen if you have to kill, and killing is destructive of the soul. There are some that get through it. I've studied this extensively. The psychiatric literature is voluminous, and they've discovered that there's a small group, I mean, tiny percentage of men who are in a gruesome combat situation and yet escape without PTSD. And the study that I recall involved, they can't find very many of them that were unaffected, but there was 10 or 12 in this group that came through it, and they didn't have PTSD, not hardly any symptoms of it even. And what they discovered is that these men had not had their spirituality destroyed in basic training. They saw through the fallacy of renouncing their, you know, religious precepts of thou shalt not kill. They maintained that. They didn't take on their cruelty into battle. They did not rape. They didn't mutilate corpses, which was very common in the heat of combat, especially in Vietnam, it was common. They didn't kill civilians. They were merciful to the civilians that were injured. They did acts of mercy and compassion to their buddies. They kept intact their desire to survive. They were looking to survive. They did everything they could to make it through. And then the unusual thing, the thing that they were lucky, was that they had a commanding officer who was reasonable, who didn't push them into suicide missions. And it was real common, especially in Vietnam. There were young men who didn't know very much, and they were also obeying orders from their superiors to do certain missions that the soldiers themselves knew were probably suicidal. And so these men were able to convince their commanding officers to not do suicidal missions, and they were lucky enough to have a commanding officer who would listen to them. Usually they're just black and white, and they say, I have to do this, you know, and do it, and then go into a suicide situation. But these were men who listened to reason. So it was a set of unusual situations, 10 or 12 different facets that managed to them for them to survive the experience intact spiritually, too. The woods are loaded in this country with affected Vietnam veterans. They call them tripwire vets, where they are so concerned with, they're still hypervigilant. They listen for people coming up behind them, and they think it's the enemy. They immediately have this flashback, oftentimes, if they hear somebody behind them, or they think there's dangers out there. They just have this pervasive fear of the enemy. And so they're so mentally ill that and they're so isolate themselves because, well, I should get into this other thing, that they tend to isolate themselves because they alienate their families. They tend to be violent themselves. They tend to be sexually violent to their wives and children. They tend to be physically violent to their wives and children. They also traumatize other people. They come back victims of violence, but they've developed this cruel streak, and this hair trigger, your hair trigger situation, and their reliance on violence, and they tend to also cause post-traumatic stress disorder in their family members. Every affected Vietnam veteran affects at least four other people in their family and cause PTSD in their loved ones by being violent or being physically abusive, et cetera, et cetera. So pretty soon they're alienated from their family. They have a horrible divorce rate. They have 85% of them that are seriously affected have a severe chemical dependency problem. They can't hold a job. They lose their jobs. They drink away whatever money they have, and pretty soon they're on the street. And one-third of America's homeless population are affected Vietnam veterans. One-third of American homeless people are affected Vietnam veterans, the ones that haven't killed themselves already. So I could go on and on. It's a terrible situation that happened in World War II, happened in World War I. Happened in the, you name the war, and people are affected by the violence. Now, I should tell you some of the history. Sigmund Freud, we all have heard of Sigmund Freud. He was a genius of a psychiatrist. Early in his career, 100 years ago, to the year, he was in the process of investigating a disease called hysteria. Hysteria is a female disease. It's a mental illness that causes a multitude of symptoms. It's been very common all through history because women are victims of violence frequently. And in Vienna, around the time of Freud, which is where Freud practiced, there was a high incidence of this hysteria, which was neurotic and psychotic features. Oftentimes there's numbness and paralysis and fake seizures, and basically it was post-traumatic stress disorder, but it wasn't labeled that back then. And in 1896, he published a study called The Etiology of Hysteria. There was sort of a race going on among medical professionals back then to find out who could figure out the cause of it. There were some doctors in Paris, France, that were searching for the cause, and Freud was among them. And these women would come in with horrible mental illnesses, and I think it's probably the same type of people around Jesus' time who had demons. There was tremendous physical and sexual abuse of women at the time of Jesus too, and so this disease has been present probably from the time men started beating their wives or started having, there were wars and things like that. But anyway, Freud started actually talking to his women patients, which hasn't happened since and didn't happen before, where male doctors actually spent a lot of time talking with their patients. Men physicians tend to just be, say, well, what's your problem? And I got 2 minutes, and got their hand on the doorknob, and not really listening, not really talking. But for a decade there, psychiatrists were actually talking to women and getting their stories. And what Freud found out was astonishing. These women with hysteria were all sexually abused and physically abused, and oftentimes by their parents. Now, these patients of Freud's were wealthy enough to be able to afford him, and so these were the families that were upstanding families, wealthy. They had prestige. Some of them were his psychiatrist friends as the victimizers. And so he did the study. It was an elegant a paper that he wrote, and he says, I know what's causing hysteria. It's sexual abuse. He called it seduction, or premature sexual experience. He didn't call it, a sexual abuse. And so he started presenting his paper to his colleagues at various medical meetings, and he got the cold shoulder. He thought this was a fantastic revelation. He had it nailed. He understood post-traumatic stress disorder. And yet he saw that his career was going down the tube, and he couldn't figure it out. And within a year, he recanted of his findings, and he said, couldn't be. You know, if what I found is true, then the parents of my patients are perverts, and that couldn't be. They were upstanding citizens. One of them was his closest confidant, Wilhelm Fleece. His closest confidant, Sigmund Freud was Wilhelm Fleece, who was also a psychiatrist. And right about the time when Freud recanted, turned his back on the whole hysteria and PTSD problem, was exactly the year when Wilhelm Fleece was sexually abusing his son, who later became a psychiatrist and who revealed the information. So among the various reasons Freud turned his back on a fantastic revelation was, I'm sure, the pressure that his friend put on him to recant the story. So all of a sudden, now we don't have anybody defending the women victims. And there's a lack of understanding, lack of interest in the whole process until World War I. World War I was a horrible war, trench warfare, tremendous suffering. 8 million men died in the trenches in Europe. It lasted 4 years. It destroyed 4 European empires, caused tremendous suffering and poverty and destruction of the infrastructure. It was a horrible war. 4 million on either side died, and there was so much carnage that they just quit. They just couldn't stand it anymore. 50,000 men dying in one battle in one day. It's just carnage like you can't believe. And the survivors came home with the exact same symptoms of hysteria that the women up until then had had. And men aren't supposed to, you know, get hysteria. You know, it's a female disease. Hyster means womb, uterus. And the other word for a uterus is hyster. Hysterectomy is the removal of the uterus. And they thought that they named it that because they thought it must come from the womb. Only women had it, so it must be from the womb. You know, they didn't have any concept of what the cause was. But here these men are coming home from war with hysteria symptoms, terribly affected psychologically, you know, just disabled. And there are still some in our veterans nursing homes that are not very many left anymore, but disabled for life, unemployable, suffering the daily nightmares and the insomnia and the guilt and the psychological trauma symptoms.
Is that known as shell shock?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they thought it was shell shock. They thought the men who survived the war were affected by the percussion trauma, you know, the blast, and then they thought that must affect the brain, and so that must cause, psychological trauma. Thank you. Then they call it battle fatigue, and in the Civil War they call it nostalgia. I mean, there's various names throughout the various wars through history, and they didn't nail it until they didn't understand it. Freud understood it, but not many people understood it until the 1970s and 80s, when the Vietnam veterans came home and exposed the truth about war and what happened. So anyway, Freud had it nailed, and it wasn't even popular until World War I. Hundreds of thousands of men came home psychologically incapacitated, and there were various, there's interest, then again, even the Pentagon, or the Department of War, was interested for a while, because they didn't, you know, they, men who are incapacitated by PTSD are lousy soldiers. You know, they don't know which way is up, and so they have to be taken away. They can't be good soldiers anymore. And the military psychiatrists were interested in trying to figure out what was causing it, so they could get them back into, they wanted an effective treatment, they could get them back into the front lines again. They were supposed to be out there to kill the enemy, you know, they didn't want them in a military hospital somewhere, so they worked hard on trying to figure out some cure. One of the psychiatrists thought, well, these guys are cowards, so he would shame them, and they would use electric shock treatments. One of the patients had as one of his symptoms the inability to talk. He was mute from the trauma, and this, you know, there's all sorts of things, and one thing, they may not be able to talk, or they stutter, or something like that. So he thought, well, this guy's a coward. Obviously, you know, he's got hysteria, and so they shocked him. They tried electric shock on him, and obviously it didn't work. You know, they were actually torturing the victims, you know, on top of their already victimhood. And But then there wasn't a war for a while, and so they forgot it. But the Pentagon remembered, you know, well, these guys maybe are cowards, or maybe they have some psychological defect, and we could maybe screen them out. So they devised a big study. They devised a questionnaire to, that every World War II inductee was to take, and they screened out hundreds of thousands, actually millions, of men who they thought may be potential victims of PTSD. Same thing happened. They screened out these guys they thought were going to have PTSD, and the same thing happened. Of the 800,000 combat veterans in World War II, 300,000 of them were affected with PTSD. They did a film study of many of the victims. A very famous film director, and I'm blocking his name right now, did a film for the Pentagon interviewing these men that had the PTSD from World War II combat. Very powerful movie, and because it was so powerful and so truthful, the Pentagon suppressed it. And it's now available in the Freedom of Information Act, but the War Department suppressed it. It was too truthful and too dramatic. So yeah, you're getting the idea. The Vietnam veteran is the most studied subject of PTSD, but the same thing happens in physical abuse, domestic, physical abuse in our homes. Same thing happens in sexual abuse in our homes, incest, wife battering. It's mainly a male-induced disease. Men are the ones that are in combat. Men are the ones that abuse their wives. Men are, by and large, the vast majority are men who do it. It's a male disease. And in our male-dominated society, it's not very popular to talk about male, foibles and weaknesses. And so that's why you in this audience may not really know very much about this syndrome. That's why what I'm saying is maybe a little shocking. It's a little shocking to me when I kind of discovered it. The treatment is extremely difficult in severe cases. I've been at the VA hospital. They know a lot about it. They have fantastic support groups among Vietnam veterans that are affected, and they come in frequently, and these guys still look lost, and they're still, they still have their depression. They can't sleep at night. They're alienated from their families, so they don't have the support of their own families. They can't believe in a loving God anymore, so they don't have the church, to support them. It's a terrible spiritual problem that our churches, mainline churches, are not addressing. These are people that don't go to church. If they go there, they don't see any relevance. The church is irrelevant to people who have PTSD because they don't teach what Jesus taught about violence, that it's forbidden to those who wish to follow him. And that's part of the problem. It's our failure. The churches are failing to teach what Jesus taught about violence. We're failing to teach our seminary graduates about Christian nonviolence. We are not addressing it from the pulpit. We're not addressing it in our Sunday schools. I didn't learn about Christian nonviolence until a couple years ago. I think I taught my own kids about it, that Jesus was a peaceful person and merciful and refused to kill and refused to injure anybody, and taught that and lived it. I wasn't told in my upbringing that it was okay to be a conscientious objector to war, that it was okay to be an objector to killing another human being. Wasn't taught that, and I suspect that most of us weren't. Later in the week, I'll be talking, going into more detail about Christian nonviolence, the truths about that, and why we don't hear much about it, why we don't teach what Jesus taught about violence. It's an interesting story, and I hope most of you will be able, will follow up on that and come to the session on Love Your Enemies in a couple days, and on Saturday, one on Christian nonviolence, and another one on Thursday, too, about the violence of Nagasaki, you know, Christians using the biggest cathedral, Christian cathedral in the Orient, as ground zero for the Nagasaki bomb. That was our target. You know, Christians vaporized the Christian community of Nagasaki in 9 seconds, and the Imperial Japanese tried to do it over a 200-year period and couldn't eliminate Christianity in Nagasaki. But us Americans, an all-American bomb crew, did it in 9 seconds. You know, I'm going to talk about that on Thursday, plus a lot of other interesting things about what happens when the church fails to talk about what Jesus talked about and did, and the reasons for that. So it's a serious problem, and I haven't been following this, but I think we have it. I'm going to ask for feedback or questions right now. This is a topic that I could spend 8 hours on, and I'm sure to really thoroughly understand it for you, we could do that and do it very profitably, but we, of course, are limited by the hour. I would very much welcome anybody here that wants to continue the discussion. You know, I'm sure this is a troubling thing. I'm sure most of us know somebody who's affected in our relationship, even, you know. I think a lot of people who, I know a lot of people are affected by the existence of an affected veteran in their family that may have been to war and then an alcoholic and then violent to the family or neglectful of the family or abusive in some way, and then that ripples out. Violence begets violence begets violence, and there, when there's someone violent in our family, then that somehow affects the next generation. And I've seen this proved out many, many times in my patients at the mental institution, where they were victims of a violent parent, usually a violent father who was alcoholic, but he may have been alcoholic because of some emotional trauma that he was trying to suppress. And so he was a victim, you know. That's one thing I tell my patients, you know. So you're a victim. You're a perpetrator of violence to your own children. That has to stop. But you have to reconcile with the one who was violent to you. It may have been a parent who was also a victim. And when they see it from that standpoint, they're more able to forgive. They're more able to reconcile with that violent parent by understanding that that father may have been a victim of violence somewhere along the line, and he was out of control because he was mentally ill. So this is a mechanism I've developed of healing the individual. After patients understand, and most patients have never even heard of post-traumatic stress disorder, most of them are in the chemical dependency department, have no concept that violence may have been the root cause of why they're chemically dependent. And so just explaining that to them and walking them through the process, they suddenly, you know, there's a look of recognition on their face, and they say, now I know how I got where I'm at. Never knew that before. I thought I was a bad person. I thought I was a drunk. You know, in the 12-step program, they say, I don't care where it came from, just stop drinking. You know, just say no, that simplistic. I'm not faulting the 12-step program, so probably the best we got, short of the VA program, Veterans Administration programs, who really understand it and deal with both issues at the same time. They deal with the violence issues at the same time as the chemical dependency issues. It takes a lot more effort, a lot more expense, a lot more time, but it's far more effective than only dealing with the chemical dependency issue and ignoring the root cause. But the 12-step program's fault is that they don't deal with the root cause. They don't deal with the violence that is usually at the root. Now, that's not 100% of the time. There are exceptions of recreational drug abuse and in a perfectly nonviolent setting. That does happen. I'm not saying that all chemical dependency is a result of violence. But it's extremely prevalent, and when it isn't addressed, the recurrence rate of the chemical dependency is high. You know, the best any 12-step program gets is 70% failure rate, you know. 70% failure rate, where they come back and they haven't gotten any better. They might, they stop drinking while they're in the hospital, but without addressing the root causes, they just fall back into the same pattern, and it's a tremendous drain to society. So PTSD, the effect of violence, is a tremendous social problem, it's a tremendous social expense, tremendous psychological toll to these terrible, suffering people. I mean, it just tears your heart out when you see that these are the decent people who got sucked into, victimized by our military society, thinking it was great to be a Marine, and then going in there, getting despiritualized in basic training, learning to dehumanize the enemy, you know, calling them gooks and chinks and, you know, all the bad names. They, in infantry training and Marine training, they make a big point of not regarding the enemy as any as human, but rather as subhuman, slant eyes, and then they have all sorts of horrible names, and you get degraded when you try to be humane to the enemy. That's part of the war-making process, is demonizing the enemy, making them like an animal so that they deserve to die, or that you don't have to feel guilty in killing them. So you get sucked into that situation, and it's the killer of the soul. You know, the terrible, terrible spiritual problems with only rare exceptions. And again, it depends on the severity and the intensity, the duration of the trauma. One of the problems, you know, after every war, the Pentagon kind of learns a lesson, you know. So they learned after World War I, well, we better try to screen out the frail ones, the weak ones, the cowards. And they did that, didn't work. So after World War II, when combat veterans were in there 2, 3, 4 years, they said, well, it's the duration of the combat experience that causes PTSD, will shorten it to 12 months. So they shortened it to 12 months in Vietnam, 13 months for Marines. Marines are always are tougher, and they always have to do it better. So the 13 months for Marines, 12 months limit for combat on the ground in Vietnam. So what happened? They went there for 12 months, but they didn't have unit cohesiveness. They were always having guys coming in, end of their 12-month tour, and then they had a new one coming in. And they weren't in sync. So there was always somebody leaving and always a new one coming in. So they didn't develop any unit cohesiveness. And knowing that they're only there for 12 months, they didn't work as a unit either. They said, I only got 2 months to go. I'm not going to do anything ridiculous. And so they didn't participate in the combat plan, et cetera, which was a risk to the rest of the unit. And there are a lot of reasons why the 12-month tour of duty turned out, they thought it was going to be a good idea, it turned out to be a lousy idea. And what also happened is that after their tour of duty was over, in 24 hours, they were back in the States. They didn't have a chance to get debriefed. They didn't go back. You know, sometimes in World War II, it took 2 weeks to get back by boat from World War II, the killing fields in Europe, and they had a chance to talk this out. They kind of helped themselves by talking out, commiserating with each other. Here, one guy ended his tour of duty. He was on the plane by himself and back in civilian life. No chance to talk it out, and he went crazy fast. And he didn't understand what was going on. The military just said, you're on your own, and it was horrible, and it still is. Let's stop here for questions.
The other thing I was going to say is when the vets came back from World War II, we welcomed them with open arms. When the Vietnam vets came back, there were many people who were angry with them.
Yeah. Right.
So, I mean, they had a double whammy.
That's true. It was a minor factor. It's always brought up and said, well, it was a civilian's fault. It's a factor, but a minor factor. There was that lack of support,
right,
for sure. Yeah, that's true.
You know.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, I mean, there was somebody that was to blame for the carnage and the butchery that was Vietnam, but it wasn't the soldier.
Right.
It was his higher-ups, the Pentagon, the National Security Council, the CIA did absolutely atrocious stuff. I read about Operation Phoenix in Laos sometime. tens of thousands of Vietnamese brutally murdered at the hands of our CIA operatives. So those in positions of power are the ones to blame. They're hidden behind the doors of the boardrooms and the National Security Council rooms, and they are immune from criticism. If the Secretary of War doesn't want to appear for an interview, or if he wants non-hostile newsmen to interview him, he can arrange that, you know, so he can orchestrate that so he doesn't ever feel the guilt. Other questions? Question.
Is there hope for treatment?
Severe cases, boy, I mean, people are still getting, the symptoms are sometimes come way delayed. So there are still people from Vietnam that are just getting their PTSD now. They immerse themselves in a job, for instance, or they get addicted to something else. You know, they get addicted to their work, workaholics. And when they retire, so we're going to have a rash now, I think, that memory is still in the brain, ready to erupt and cause the horrible symptoms. And so as long as they can work hard to suppress it by doing something else, engaging other activities, they can kind of keep it under wraps. Or they may be using alcohol a lot to get to sleep at night, or they may be mildly affected for a while. But the more severe cases, it almost always happens sometime. The treatment that is intensive with compassionate psychiatrists and caregivers, a supportive family, a loving family, and a healthcare team that really understands the patient, and there's mutual respect, there's some hope. I've seen, just about every study I've read about, you know, where they said, well, we'll study this group of Vietnam veterans for a year now, and just about all of them, before the year is out, and these are aware treatment teams that are dealing with these, there's usually a few that committed suicide before the study ran out. So even with super treatment, the guilt, the terrible guilt, and that's a big issue, is the guilt. You go into a situation and your best buddy, the one you rely on, the only one that you have any affection for and confidence in, dies. And contrary to TV and movies, when people get shot, they don't die immediately, painlessly. They scream and they suffer. They may not die for a day or two or a week or two or a month or two, but they suffer. They're bleeding in the mud. They're crying for their mama. You know, it's a horrible scene, and we don't get the truth on the tube. So they feel, here they are, they think they should do something, and they can't do anything for their dying, screaming buddy, and they feel guilt. And then they come back and they wonder, why did he die and not me? You know, and they're tormented by that. And they know that they should go and tell their buddy's parents about the death, but they don't dare, you know. And of course, most of the people that die in war are told that they died defending their country and they were heroes. But I tell you, you know, most of them died not feeling very heroic. In fact, one of my patients personally saw four of his buddies kill themselves with their own handguns while they were in Vietnam. This was before they got out of the war. They couldn't stand the mental pain. They killed themselves rather than go on. That's the only way they knew how to get out of it. You know darn well that those parents weren't told that they died heroically, you know. That would blow the cover of the war-making machinery if we started admitting all the suicides that happened afterwards and all the suicides that happened during and all the rapes of innocent civilians, you know, the unchristlikeness of combat war. And we're not even talking about the civilian victims, you know. You've heard all the furor about the MIAs, the missing in action, the American missing in action. There's a couple thousand that we haven't accounted for, and we get all upset about a couple thousand men that haven't come back yet. Do you know how many men that the Vietnamese have unaccounted for? 500,000 Vietnamese combat soldiers are unidentified. They do not know where they are, where they're buried, or any 500,000 Vietnamese. You ever hear about that with a POW MIA issue? No. Those are slant eyes. They're not Americans, you know? That's the attitude the military gets. They're subhuman, and therefore we can kill them. You have to do it. That's the process of going to war. You have to demonize the enemy. You have to make them be a very bad threat to us, and you have to make them subhuman.
What are the statistics on Korea?
Well, it's prevalent, and that one hasn't been studied as well. It's sort of between, you know, the really popular war of World War II and then the brutality of Vietnam, where there was a relative openness. I mean, we saw a lot of the gore coming out of it. And Korea is sort of a hidden one. It's sort of an occupation, another undeclared war. But it's very, very prevalent, the ones that were in combat. And it's only 5 or 10% of military people in any given war actually see combat. Most of them are in support groups. They're up desks somewhere. They're lobbing bombs from a distance. You know, most of them aren't at combat. It's only 5 or 10% in any war. So when someone says, well, I was in Vietnam, I wasn't affected, well, you know, ask him what he did. Did he see any blood and guts and gruesome death or injury? Chances are he didn't if he wasn't affected. So that's important to know. The enemy of the state is a child of God who is loved by God and therefore is to be loved by us fellow children of God, especially if we're Christian. Christians are to follow Jesus. Jesus was nonviolent. He taught an ethic of unconditional love of friend and enemy. It's clear. If we are to be disciples of Jesus and imitators of Jesus, don't we have to follow what Jesus did and taught? Seems like the answer is clear. And in the first 300 years of Christianity, the church regarded itself as a pacifist church. They were conscientious objectors to war. They understood that killing was outside the mind of Christ. Jesus was a pacifist. The apostles were pacifists. The violent Saul, who was a persecutor of the Christians, became the nonviolent Paul. After that conversion to Christianity, he understood what Jesus was all about. He refused to kill. He was willing to suffer and die, but not willing to kill. Early Christianity was nonviolent religion. And it's clear, it's all over the pages of the gospel, and we as a church don't see it. And one of the reasons, and again, this is another lecture that can take 8 hours, and we will touch on it, you know, with more intensity and comprehensiveness at the next lectures. But one of the reasons is that we feel as a church that we need to be cooperating with the state, you know. We don't want to be at odds with the state. I mean, we think that might, you know, if we were at war with the state, you know, refusing to send our boys to the wars that our state chooses to fight, then we will be frowned upon and maybe we'll get our real estate tax exemption denied. They have that power. The state has the power to tax us. Right now they choose not to tax our real estate. And so, you know, we said, well, we better not do anything or it'll be more expensive to have our church property, et cetera. And then other things, of course. We want to be, you know, we want to be cooperative with the state. But you know what the state says? You know what Jesus said about love of enemies? And even Paul said, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him drink. You know, Matthew 25 is all about being merciful to the other, the enemy. Jesus said, love your enemies. That's one of the few things the biblical scholars all agree on. That's the original words of Jesus, love your enemies. There's no question about that. It wasn't a throwaway line. He lived it, and everybody, the early church who knew him, knew it. And the most common quotation from Jesus in the first 2 centuries of the church was, love your enemies. They understood it and lived it. And yet, in our Constitution, in the United States Constitution, the definition of treason is aiding and abetting the enemy, and it's punishable by death, hanging. That's the only, our Constitution, that's the only thing. Can you think of anything more at odds with Christianity than what our Constitution says? You know, You can be hung if you aid and abet the enemy. Jesus and Paul says, if your enemy needs aiding and abetting, you aid and abet them. That's worth thinking about.
Jan,
yes.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
And also, we're told now by, I don't know, the psychologist or who, that when there's an abuser, the child abuser particularly, they will do it again and again. There's no cure for that. And I'm wondering what you want to comment on that.
Yeah, that's right. Abusers, childhood abusers are very difficult to treat because they have also been victimized generally at some stage in early in their life. So they probably have PTSD. And it's, you know, the longer it is that it doesn't get treated, the more ingrained it gets and the more sexually inappropriate those patients are. So when you have sexual abuse, you do sexually inappropriate things, your personality development tends to be retarded at the stage that you were abused in many respects. And so they have sexually inappropriate or sexually confusing lifestyles. And that's when it happens early in life, it gets ingrained and embedded. And it's very difficult to treat those that have been sexually abused as children.